This is A New Angle, a show about cool people doing awesome things in and around Montana. I'm your host, Justin Angle. This show is supported by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and the University of Montana College of Business. Hey folks, welcome back, and thanks for tuning in. Today is our March edition of Incentives and Instincts, a recurring series in which I speak with economist and friend Bryce Ward about some of the broader challenges facing our society. Bryce, thanks for joining me today.
Happy to be here as always.
So, last month, we talked about the widening ideological divide between Gen Z men and women across the globe. We highlighted the increased prevalence of zero-sum thinking in Gen Z as the causal mechanism, but there's a lot more to say about this. Before we get into that, Bryce, let's just set the table a little bit, remind listeners what zero-sum thinking is, and how do we know it's on the rise?
Okay, zero-sum thinking is the idea that policy outcomes or whatever it is, or even just any kind of action, is I win, you lose, right? Yeah. So my gains come at your loss, or my losses, your gains come at my loss. And zero sum means that it balances out, right? So you take what's exactly equal to my loss. How do we know what's happening? You know, there's an important paper came out last year on the rise of zero sum thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, large sample of Americans, to ask them a bunch of questions to figure out where they were on the zero sum spectrum. And then, you know, simple plotting it by age. You see, that zero-sum thinking is much less common amongst older Americans, and it has been rising amongst more recent birth cohorts. And again, this is not a left or right phenomenon.
Sure.
Both the left and the right have their versions of preferred policies, which I think you can think of as zero-sum or negative-sum. It's, you know, where I'm trying to gain at your expense. And so, yeah, that's kind of where we're at.
One of the things that's predictive of lower levels of zero-sum thinking is if you have experienced economic growth or increase in economic opportunity during some point in your formative years as a young person. So if you think about Gen Z, this is the group that experienced the financial crisis in their early age and the slow economic recovery and some of the rise of, I don't know if it's necessarily the rise of income inequality, but definitely the rise in the salience of income inequality. Now they're coming of age, and it makes some sense that zero-sum mindset is maybe elevated in this group.
There's the fact that the economy really did grow slowly from the Great Recession up until really the 2018-2019.
Yeah.
Then you get hit by COVID, and you know the economy's actually been very robust since, but so there's an economic issue, but there's also just the fact that cultural issues have become much more salient. And many of our culture wars are zero sum.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Sort of by definition.
Almost by definition, it's about I win, you lose, right? You know, the only way for me to win is by you losing.
Yes.
Right? Economics is always, there's almost always a positive sum reframing, mm-hmm. right? You know, we can figure out how to grow the pie and then allocate the pie in a way that leaves people better off. But with some culture war issues, not all, but many of the culture war issues, there's no win-win. There's no way for me to, you know, if you're an ardent anti-abortion person,
sure,
there's no compromise there.
Yeah.
Right? The only way for, you know, the pro-choice side to get what it wants is to impose something that you don't like on you.
Yeah.
And so a lot of culture war issues have that aspect to them. And so I think that's another reason why, you know, whereas for a lot of the post-war period, there were the culture war issues existed. They would rise and fall in salience, but economic issues were the bread and butter.
Our presidential politics have become a culture war.
Absolutely.
Like you're either pro-Trump or you are a socialist and want the death of the United States as we've known it. You are either pro-Biden or you are for the destruction of our democracy and that system. So both sides at the presidential level are framing the choice as an existential one. That's not necessarily new, but the language we've used to describe it in the last couple elections is new in my view.
Yeah, everything is, this is the most important election ever.
Yeah.
It's everything is existential. If the other side wins, it's the end of the country. And that's new. I don't think that's, you know, elections had consequences. Elections mattered. There were distasteful negative ads that, you know, were probably not good from a societal standpoint. But it wasn't like it was some policy that was at issue.
Sure.
Yeah. Right? If this person wins, they're going to raise your taxes. Or if this person wins, they're going to cut your Social Security. And those are still issues. In fact, those are the real issues.
Absolutely.
But, you know, yeah, in the last decade or so, we have injected a higher level of stakes. In part, you know, in part, it's because we've been in a perpetual cycle of close elections. And so, well, how do I get people to show up and vote? Is I try and convince them that there is enormous stakes. Yeah. We don't have low turnout elections, right? Election, you know, so from a participation standpoint, this apparently works.
Yeah, people are engaged.
People are engaged. And people are getting pushed into tribes because we don't have the same number of swing voters that we used to have.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of that is, yeah, we've somehow fallen into a world of elevated stakes for everything.
And one thing that that appears to be linked to when we're talking about sort of the stability of the system, both sides talking about the stability of the system and the need to sort of avoid destruction of the system, that sort of leads to this. It's connected in a way to this construct we want to talk about today, and that is need for chaos. There appears to be a growing segment of the populace that is exhibiting this need for chaos variable that and it seems to be distributed evenly or somewhat evenly across the political divide. What is need for chaos and how does it fit in here?
Need for chaos is useful to understand we got to here, right? And so the original thing was a bunch of researchers wanted to understand who spread conspiracy theories online.
Right.
All right. So they created a whole bunch of outlandish scenarios about all types of sides and politicians. And then, in an experiment, they gave them to people and said, would you share this online?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they saw a lot of what you expect to see, which is partisans were quite willing to share conspiracy theories about the out-group.
Sure.
But they found this group of people who were willing to share conspiracy theories about everybody.
Yeah.
So this motivated them to dig deeper. They basically found that there's a group of people, you know, so about 30% of populations exhibit some need for chaos, right?
Yeah.
I.e., they have, you know, these are people who are motivated by status, and they think they can get status via destruction. And there's like 5% of the population who is need for chaos and no partisanship at all, right? So they're just burn it all down,
mm-hmm.
right? They just want any elite, any institution, they're happy to burn it all down.
Gum up the works, you know, at every opportunity.
Yeah, so you know, this is just a specific subcase of zero-sum thinking.
Yeah.
People with a preference almost for negative sum. It's somewhat crazy, right? Because it requires an assumption that if we tear down the system, that I will be better off, right? Burn it all down, magic happens, and I will be better off.
Yeah, I mean, that it requires a crazy rationale to justify it. Although
I guess a better term is magical thinking, right?
Certainly it's magical thinking.
X happens, wave a wand.
Right.
And this is somehow leaves me better off.
Or that some better system will just sort of magically appear.
The magic of destruction will create something in its place that will be better, at least for me.
Yeah. And is this really something new? I mean, there's always sort of been this throw the bums out sentiment in politics across, you know, across the ages.
There's always been disaffection. The way I think of it, this is just the Joker, right? The Joker's been around as a character forever, mm-hmm. or not forever, but since 1940.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's always been this element of this recognition that there is somebody or some people out there who just want chaos. Whether it's been at this, I mean, this is, we're just discovering or just labeling this, right? This, you know, this need for chaos.
Sure. So it's not necessarily something new or just coming up with a new name.
Because it's a new idea.
Yeah.
We don't have some form of consistent measurement that we can go back and say, oh, you know, I guess what we can look at is, you know, institutional support.
Yes.
you know, Americans used to believe in their institutions.
They don't anymore. Yeah, and trust in our neighbors, social isolation, all these things that we've talked about many times.
Yeah, and look, certainly since the 60s, you know, there's been people who want to change the system or radically change the system. You know, you can think of all the different movements over time. You know, there's always been somebody who wants a very different system.
Yeah.
The question is where, you know, how prevalent is it and how much power do they have? You know, where is this still a fringe group? Is this something that's more mainstream? Is this scaled at a level that we haven't seen before?
Right.
And that's where, because we don't have long-term measurement, we don't know how much this undercurrent has always been with us and how today is different than whatever has existed in the past.
I mean, from a certain standpoint, there is something heartening happening in the sense that, you know, we're in this world where we think we're polarized and that everything comes down to this just political ideology dimension. Yet, you know, last month we talked about zero-sum thinking and how it is prevalent on both sides of the aisle. And now we're talking about need for chaos, which appears to be prevalent in relative numbers across the aisle. So these are not necessarily factors that we're trying to promote, but they are unifying in a sense. That unification might actually be dangerous, though.
Yeah, that's the concern, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that's where modern technology becomes concerning.
Yes.
Is it's a way of consolidating all of the individual jokers who used to exist into an army of jokers.
Yes, and amplifying them.
You know, I mean, 5% of voters, I mean, that's 8 million people.
Yeah.
Right? An army of 8 million jokers sowing chaos in the system is not something that's easily dealt with.
Mm-hmm. So it's somewhat easy to see how this type of thinking would emerge and how that type of thinking might exist on both sides of the aisle. So let's talk about this amplification piece. And you mentioned the word scale a moment ago. There's a danger in this that's associated with its scalability. How do you think about scale in this context?
I mean, scale is the fundamental problem, right? So if you ask me what's the fundamental issue under all of these kind of the things that we, a lot of the ills that we talk about,
mm-hmm.
right? It's that we have a society and an economy that has scaled to such a level that it creates some issues in its wake and issues that we have not dealt with. And it's because we haven't dealt with them that you end up with highly prevalent zero-sum thinking and need for chaos, right? And what happens with scale? Well, scale itself is fine, right? But when you have a networked economy at scale, you get what are known as superstar effects. Right. This is where, you know, a small number of highly successful people can serve a large portion of the market and capture the returns to that. But lurking in its wake is it's not just about money. It's also about contribution and status.
Mm.
Right. When you have a small scale economy, well, everybody, you know, in the local community has a job to do.
Right.
That is recognized within the community.
Sure.
And while, you know, it may not generate the same level of economic security because the pie is smaller, it does generate more status, right? You have all your local shopkeepers.
Sure.
Are high
local
status
entrepreneurs.
Positions.
Yep.
You know, the mechanic is a high status because you know Joe,
mm-hmm.
and Joe's my mechanic, and I got a relationship with Joe.
And you trust Joe.
I trust
yes.
Joe, and, you know, and we have a relational economy, you know, and you, so you kind of go through, you know, there was just in a smaller scale economy, you don't have the same level of inequality of economic outcomes, and you don't have the same level of inequality in status, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, with the need for chaos, people, status-sensitive people who feel marginalized.
And we're all status-sensitive to
some
degree.
We are humans. We are all status-sensitive, right? You know, most of petty jealousy, envy, greed, all of these types of things are usually about status, right?
Yeah.
And so when we have status scarcity, when you have inequality where it's like, oh, that person, they get all the status, they get all the attention, they get, you know. And again, that's where the digital technology feeds this, right?
Yes.
Is now I can pay even more attention to this small group of people who have all the status, the influencers all the way up to the celebrities and the tycoons. And, you know, we have all this language and we can spend hours a day paying attention to their lives, right? In ways that we used to spend meddling in each other's lives.
Well, and not only that, like the methods we use to pay attention to their lives, meaning the device and the social media platform, are both designed to addict us to those platforms, right? So it's not only the message itself of being, you know, the superstar that we're interested in is attractive, but the platform and the device through which we consume their content is also attractive. So we're working against a lot of factors. We'll be back to my conversation with Bryce Ward after this short break. A New Angle is supported by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and UM's College of Business. Access to capital, broadband, and education are three ingredients any community needs for success.
This is University of Montana President Seth Bodner, and you're listening to A New Angle.
Welcome back to A New Angle. I'm here with Bryce Ward, discussing zero-sum thinking and the need for chaos.
Yeah, we just exist in these parasocial relationships where we, with people that we like, we're like, oh, look, that person's on YouTube now, or they're on a podcast now,
sure,
or they're on Twitter, Instagram, and I can just pay attention to their lives and, you know, feel connected in some way. It takes hard work to develop skills and recognize the opportunities to apply those skills in ways that are valued in the community.
Sure.
What I think amongst this notion of need for chaos is that there's just some people for whom it's not enough.
So straw man argument here for argument's sake, I mean, scale, it's argued that it can be democratizing, right? Like, hey, you know, it enables a musician, a creator, whoever, to put their content out there and let the market reveal them. They can find their own audience. There are so few barriers to entry. If you want to start a podcast, write a book, do anything, you can put it online and find an audience. So there's an illusion of opportunity here. There's an illusion that, hey, I could be that superstar too.
We have plenty of examples of people who have followed those paths,
yeah,
right? You know,
yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's nice to take some of the gatekeeping power out of a potentially predatory executive or an industry or whatever it is. That all sounds very nice and good. The challenge is, if I don't want to be a podcaster or an influencer or some form of digital media celebrity,
right?
Where do I find status and meaning, right? And it still exists. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. It's just that it's, you know, the pathway towards it, it used to be kind of, it was just kind of laid out, right? You know, these are your pathways. This is where you can find some degree of status or whatever it was. But again, there's two parts to it. One is, you know, it's not just about absolute levels of status. It's also about relative levels of status.
Okay.
And when you have this much inequality and, you know, superstar effects, like somebody maybe is achieving the same level of status that was, quote, the average or norm in absolute terms, is comparing them to somebody who is achieving, you know, levels of status that were previously unimaginable, you know, and we've been living in a mass media age for a long time, right? You know, like, is Taylor Swift have more status than the Beatles? I don't know.
Well, in some ways she's got less, right? Because the metrics would say she's far more successful artist than the Beatles. She's been around twice as long and, you know, sold way more music.
Because we have a wider bandwidth of platform, there are more people that she's competing with, right? I mean, the Beatles were still relatively new. There wasn't the same level of, you know, we just didn't have the prosperity to support this level of art.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
But so, you know, it's complicated, but like, yeah, I just kind of look at it. I always come back to the neighborhood or the community level.
Sure.
And the question is, do we have the same level of opportunity to contribute? And, you know, and that's where, again, scale takes some of that away,
yeah,
right? Like, it used to be, yeah, I could provide this for my community, and now the market provides it for my community. Or at the, you know, institutional governmental level, it used to be that we had the control over that outcome locally, and now it is controlled by the state or the feds. You know, we have exerted more control at different levels of government than used to exist.
And it would seem that that disconnect between the local actor and the outcome that you can affect could roll up into this need for chaos.
Yeah. I mean, agency, look, community is dependent on agency, right? You know, I mean, if you're saying, well, what is a community? It's a group of people who have some sort of shared goal, value, purpose, right? And the agency to achieve their goal or purpose,
right?
The question is, do they have the agency to affect outcomes and achieve their goal or purpose? And what are the impediments to that? And I think a lot of disaffection, right? So, you know, whether it's the pursuit of the zero-sum thinking or the need for chaos or all of this stuff, a lot of the kind of loss of trust in institutions has to do with the fact that people don't feel like they have any agency. You can vote for everybody, and then there's some other institution of government, you know, it's the Supreme Court, right? We did all the work to secure the presidency and the Congress to pass a law, and then the Supreme Court says it's illegal.
Or we're just like geographically sorted to such a huge degree that, you know, that really there's only a small handful of states that are contested anymore. So does your vote, you know, your vote as a liberal in Montana matters about as much as your vote as a conservative in California?
Yeah, you know, but yeah, it's just at every level, right? Like, oh, we secured what we wanted to get the city council to do what we want, but then the state said we couldn't do it.
Right.
Or the state court said we couldn't do it, you know, and it's like, it's part of the sclerosis that comes with an established old society is you've already kind of layered so many rules and rules and rules and rules and rules and rules and rules on top of each other that it can be hard to get things done because it's like, well, we want to do this, but because of this other situation that's kind of similar to this one that they decided that there was a rule that you said you couldn't do that and that kind of tips over into this situation, so we can't do that. And, you know, and you just – it leads to – yeah, it leads to some degree. I mean, apathy has been a problem for a long time, but it leads to not just I'm apathetic because, they're all just bums, but it's well-reasoned apathy.
We have, for years, been talking about problems like this, the decline in trust in our institutions, political polarization, our media environment. Now we're talking about zero-sum thinking and need for chaos. We've talked a little bit about AI. And a steady theme in our exchanges has been the need to be better humans. I think we're going to have to sort of connect some of those bridges in our next conversation because I think we're poised for some really big problems. We got big problems now, but all of a sudden we have artificial intelligence, you know, taking the jobs away from a whole swath of the population. If they're sitting around needing chaos, you know, that could present some deep instability in our civilization.
Yeah, you know, we need better humans and we need institutions that support them in doing something other than pursuing what they want, which is what capitalism pursues.
Yeah. So actually, let's play that out there. So capitalism does a lot. It's a system for allocating scarce resources. I say in class often that it's a terrible system, except it's better than any of the other ones we've come up with. Talk about the downsides that we know of that you're alluding to right there.
Capitalism is great as long as want and need there's an overlapping circle there, right? There, you know, the Venn diagram is exactly the same.
Okay.
But when want and need are not the same thing, capitalism gives us what we want.
Yes.
It doesn't give us what we need, right? And so if there's things that we want and we need to be reined in, right? You know, we need to turn off the dopamine switch, or we need to create counterbalancing institutions that basically don't say, hey, individual, go get whatever you want, right? You know, collectively, we require everybody to be working together. You know, so any kind of communitarian or collective impulse, you're up against a big, strong force in capitalism that basically is, well, are you an individual? Can you get what you want? And so that's where we're struggling, right? Is capitalism emerged as a powerful force, was very successful. For much of its history, it had counterbalancing forces, religion, political institutions, you know. And over the course of our lifetime, pretty much any kind of counterbalancing institution has crumbled. Right. And people still go to church, but not nearly as many.
Or right. Right.
The family,
civic institutions,
family isn't as important, you know, community is important, neighborhood isn't as important. Right. So all of the things that used to kind of be pushing back on, hey, you know what? maybe you don't always get what you want.
Yeah, and just to be clear, you would certainly acknowledge that some of those structures and institutions had huge problems. Sexism, absolutely. Racism, all sorts of isms, right? But they did provide a stabilizing function in a capitalist democracy.
They pushed back on the worst impulses of the individualistic capitalistic system.
Okay.
Right? And that's where the need for better humans, that's basically what we're saying, right, is we need humans who understand that, you know, look, in a superstar effect world, lying, cheating, and stealing is a great way to succeed. While many people who succeed on their own merits without resorting to nefarious tactics, you know, any story of high-flying politics, commerce, entertainment, it is rife with people of low moral character. And I feel like there's some of that probably in politics. You know, and probably in entertainment too. I mean, Harvey Weinstein is a classic example of a low character actor who used, you know, brutal tactics to maintain his position of power, right? And we have lots of stories of producers and, you know, whatever, studio executives who abused their power and probably achieved their power through backstabbing. And, you know, I mean, it creates great Shakespearean drama, right? You know, it creates great story, but the question becomes, at what point does it switch from, hey, those are the bad guys, to, hey, look, they won, right? I feel like we're seeing some of that with respect to sports, right? I'm not sure people would be as upset if people were revealed to be using PEDs as they used to be, right? Or, you know, I'm just looking at college athletics, right? The bad guys now are the people who don't pay their players. Right.
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
Right. Yeah. Like, those were the bad guys when we were in the 90s. Yeah. Right. You were cheating.
Yeah.
Right. Now, we all understood that cheating was rampant. Right. So now we've brought it above board, and now it's probably a fairer, more ethical system, because, again, it's not, in some sense, if you wanted to be a high powered college coach, we selected you based on your ability, your willingness to abuse the system. Right. At a minimum, it was about, I'm willing to turn the other way.
Yeah, a color outside the lines, or whatever metaphor you want to use.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, maybe I'm not the guy with the bag of cash paying the players. We go back to our childhood. Like, I mean, this is literally what the movie Blue Chips was about.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
Like, Nick Nolte's character didn't want to be the guy. He wanted to do it with integrity, but he's getting to the end of his career and he can't compete. So he goes to the booster, basically says, I don't want to know about it. Obviously, that this type of get ahead at any cost attitude has existed forever. Mm-hmm. The question is what's pushing back against it to make it so that it is rare as opposed to the norm?
Anyway, we got to land this ship, and we did sort of, I don't know if we quite did, but I promised to think about, like, how to make want and need overlap to a larger degree. Maybe we can talk about that in our next conversation. As always, Bryce, thanks for being here and thanks for sharing your wisdom.
All right. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks for listening to A New Angle. We really appreciate it. And we're coming to you from Studio 49. A generous gift from UM alums Michelle and Warren Hansen. A New Angle is presented by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and the University of Montana College of Business. With additional support from Consolidated Electrical Distributors, Drum Coffee, and Montana Public Radio. Kelly Larson is our producer. Maddie Jordan is our production assistant. VTO, Jeff Ament, and John Wicks made our music. And Jeff Meese is our master of all things sound. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.